This is the second interview with Phyllis Holman Weisbard, Women's Studies Librarian at the University of Wisconsin System, July 16th, 2012. Over to you, Phyllis.
Okay, so I was going to discuss some of the initiatives that I was responsible for over the course of my career. And a lot of them had to do with making our publications and services more electronic. When I got the position, was really right at the point that libraries were taking off with all this stuff, in addition to the catalog, which of course had been electronic for some time. So we started out for our office, we got a, it wasn't called a website yet, it was a gopher site. This was a type of technology developed at University of Minnesota, and hence the name gopher. And it was a more primitive version of what developed into the World Wide Web. So we got a gopher site up and running in January of 1994. And by January of 1996, it was a full-blown World Wide Web technology site. And we've continued to maintain that and develop it since then. The other main area that I was responsible for was getting our various publications online. And this was mostly and initially through commercial vendors. I negotiated contracts with these various vendors to get our materials into their databases. And of course, I was helped by university legal services, and at that time it was Henry Cuthbert. At any rate, we got contracts to put new books on women and feminism into a product called Women's Studies International, then from a company called NISC, subsequently bought out by EBSCO. And our journal, Feminist Collections, is represented in Gender Watch, which initially was from a company called Softline, and then it got bought out by the ProQuest, et cetera, people. And we're still in those. The royalties from that original NISC contract bring in about upwards of $20,000 a year in royalties. And the ProQuest one brings in about, I don't know, $100 or so. It's negligible, but it still gets us out there in the databases for the field, so that people who are doing any research on women and gender get to our stuff, which is what we always want the library to be, where the users are at, as it were. So these continue. And we've also put some of our material up ourselves. Our contracts do not preclude that. So when Minds at UW, our institutional archive, became available, we made the decision to put all of our back issues of feminist periodicals, the Table of Contents service, and of Feminist Collections, the journal, into Minds at UW. So all of our back issues are available at no charge to anyone through the institutional archive. And some of the other things that I did more specifically for Feminist Collections looked at some thematic topics. When Linda Schult was still the editor, for example, we decided to do one. And a lot is collaborative, so there's a lot of we's in this. Anyway, there was a we with Linda. We did an issue on information technology and women's studies. And then later we did one on gender, especially looking at bisexuality, transgender. So Linda and I came up with those and did those together, and they were quite popular. With Joanne Lehman, who's had the job since Linda left, we did an extensive thematic year, actually, looking at girls' studies, which is a development on its own, or it can be considered a subset of women's studies. And then we also did a series on women and religion. We were helped to kind of figure out how to divide up all of the subtopics by professor then at UW Eau Claire by the name of Lori Rowlett. Then our non-print publication, WAVE, Women's Audiovisuals in English, we also moved that into a database format and have maintained it that way ever since. So those are some of the things that that I did kind of in the electronic world. Also on my own, I do my own writing in feminist collections. I try to cover general resources, especially electronic resources, and pull out why someone in women's studies might find it useful to use that resource. So I give examples relating to women. And I've done that on things like citation tracking, web archive sites. So they're kind of generally available. I mean, I think I did them originally more on databases, but now it's more on these generally available World Wide Web resources. But how to use them effectively for women and gender-related searches. I'm also very concerned about the cost of documentaries and other media that it seems like they're increasingly popular with students and become part of the curricular materials. It's very hard for libraries to keep up with the cost of these things. The documentaries run $200.
Why don't you talk about your budget, right? Just please talk about your budget was what it is. Well, it hasn't grown.
Okay.
Just I mean, for instance, this royalties, I would have guessed $2,000, you say $20,000, so I think this could tell a reader or a listener something that they would not guess at very well.
What the office budget is?
What your collection budget is.
Oh, the collection budget. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, okay. Okay, go ahead.
So David asked me to talk a bit about the budget, as I was mentioning, the cost of these documentaries.
Doing something wrong here.
Okay.
I just don't know what. Let me see.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really sorry about this.
Yeah, all right. David asked me to talk about the budget for the collection and how that's been affected over the years. So since I've been a selector of women's studies materials, my budget has not increased really at all. I mean, there have been occasional little blips, but basically it has not. And this year we're taking a 10% cut. So I have somewhere between $16,000 and $17,000 to spend on women's studies materials in all formats, in English and in the social sciences. Since there's a women aspect to all subjects, other selectors are responsible for other parts of the interdisciplinary field of women's studies. But in terms of my own part, which is a substantial part since it's all of the theory and much of the social science-y take on women's studies, it's hard to keep up with the books, let alone with the documentaries, which cost usually $250 to $300 a piece. And yet, we know that students are very visual, media savvy, and the curriculum increasingly reflects those kind of interests. Sometimes these things become the text themselves that's analyzed, or certainly it's expected that they will be part of the curricular materials. So another thing I've done in feminist collections is take a look at what's available freely through commercial and non-commercial sites on the internet, and how to really stretch what can be made available to teaching faculty through using the search techniques that I find to be most effective. Knowing about some of the sources to search directly, and basically making use of these things. What hasn't been done particularly yet on a lot of these things is to bring them into the library catalog environment. Not that many are cataloged by any library, any of these free things, but I have put through some of the our forms to have them cataloged here so that they'll turn up routinely in the way that the material that we pay for does. Again, that's, and I have this commitment, like I said before, to, you know, being where the students or the faculty are, and I think if they're using our catalog, we have to reflect these things in the catalog. But of course, it's a cost in the time of my cataloging colleagues to do that part. I do that a lot with other free things besides the media material, also various reports and what we call gray literature. I think those also, we used to get them in print, now they're available freely on the internet. I think a good many of them should be represented in our catalog. But all of those things come at a cost, and
yeah. So there's a national resource here because you're doing the work that other libraries don't want to do or aren't doing anyway.
I think that's also true in large measure. We're really a resource center, and because this position is full-time, which even when there are people with a designation of women's studies librarian elsewhere, almost no one else has that responsibility full-time. So I do feel it as a kind of an obligation to the field and have a particular skill at working with this material. So yes, I would say that me and my office, we are really a resource for the world at large with respect to women and gender. And the other thing that I've kept up with is back to my own personal interest in Jewish women and feminism. I've done publishing in that area, whether it's, I did a massive bibliography, annotated bibliography, and archival guide to resources on American Jewish women, and that became part of a encyclopedia on American Jewish women, and then later into an online product that was more international in scope. I've done book reviews. I've presented at the Association of Jewish Libraries on Jewish feminist sources. And I also did an interview a couple years ago with Doris Gold, who founded Biblio Press. It was a Jewish feminist press. She, in some sense, started Jewish feminist publishing. And I was able to meet with her in her apartment in New York, and she showed me a lot of her memorabilia, and we talked at some length, and then I was able to write that up for Feminist Collections. She subsequently has passed away, so I'm really glad that that is in the literature also to kind of help give her her due, since I think she was so important in the history of Jewish feminist publishing. So, ask another question.
Are you ready to talk about your system role more than you have in the past, or, right?
To talk about the system role? Yeah. So, you know, I have this complicated situation where on a daily basis I operate like a member of the general library system, and so does my staff. But we are set up as a UW system office. That's how we were set up initially, and we maintain that. And that means that we have a relationship to all of the other campuses in our state system. Most of that is mediated through the UW System Women's Studies Consortium. This is a network of the programs and departments on all of the campuses, and has a director. It came out of an informal network where this was happening anyway, but it was formalized in 1989, a couple years before I got the job. And it consists of the chairs of women's studies from around the system, along with the director and me, and there's a women in science program that is housed at Oshkosh. And we usually have a representative from Extension. And we get together twice a year for usually two-day meetings. We have some projects that we do. So this gives me an opportunity to be involved in lots of projects beyond specific library duties, although often I kind of task myself with the research or bibliographic end of the project. Recently, for example, some of the directors of women's studies were concerned about childcare on their campuses, or the lack thereof, or the limited availability of it. What happens often, especially on the smaller campuses, is that women's studies becomes the seat of women's issues. So whenever anybody needs something related to women, they go to women's studies. Beyond the specific academic feature of the programs and departments. So we decided to do a study about childcare. I mean, we had data on where it existed or didn't in the system, but we wanted to do some kind of a document that was really looking at the research and using the current lingo, the evidence-based research on why having childcare facilities helps in recruitment and retention of faculty, in productivity of faculty, and especially of students. We had various criteria that we looked at. We were able to find that in the literature and write up a document that we then sent around to the chancellors of the various schools. I did a lot of the initial legwork on that in the research, and then these faculty members from the other campuses massaged and did the writing, most of the writing of the document. So that's an example of a way that I would, you know, use my skills along with them to do something. In the past, we've had two main directors of the consortium in my time, Jacqueline Ross, for about 10 years, and now Helen Klebe-Sottle. They've used me in different ways. Jackie, a little more directly, she would come up with ideas and then want to have research done about them to figure out if the consortium should go in a certain direction. So she had me do stuff on women in NAFTA, in the North American Free Trade Agreement in the 90s, women in China. She had different initiatives in her head. Not all of them did we actually follow through with, but she tapped me rather extensively. Helen leaves it a little more to my own initiative that in a way that I can, you know, volunteer on these projects like the childcare one. We have one currently to develop a textbook introduction to women's studies and have it come out under the sponsorship of the consortium. So I'm involved in that one. Similarly, still when Jackie was the director, she wanted us to do a history of the of women's studies in the state system. And I was very involved with her in hiring an initial writer, who then that didn't work out so well, then another writer to pull the rest of it out. I dug up a lot of the documents and did some suggesting of who to interview. So that book came out around 1999 or 2000. I initiated getting it and some other documents that are really the history of women and women's studies at the university onto get them made electronically and onto the through the UW Digital Collections Group. So we now have a subset of the history of the University of Wisconsin collection, which is the history of women at the University of Wisconsin. And it has these various books that and reports and things that had come out. And I was responsible for making sure that those got done and did it through and in conjunction with David Null, my colleague who is the UW archivist. At any rate, those things, that was another project essentially of the consortium that I was responsible for. The consortium today is in some flux, the UW system, because its budget has been so drastically curtailed, has decided that it no longer wants to be the home for any direct program like this. So it has had an RFP out earlier this summer to campuses to compete for being for housing the consortium in the way that my office is housed here at Madison. And I think there are maybe five applications in to house the consortium. So we don't know right now where it's going to go.
But right now it's in Madison.
Right now it's been in Madison, right in the UW system offices in Van Nuys. And that's made it certainly easier for me to collaborate with the director. It's also kept it kind of neutral with respect to campuses, since it's a, you know, kind of oversight or coordinating body for the system as a whole. So the consortium members were not really in favor of this spinning it off to a campus, but didn't really have a choice. So making the best of the situation, several of them where they thought their campus might make a good home were instrumental in urging their chancellors or provosts to put in an application. So right now we don't know where it's going to go. It could stay physically in Madison. Madison put in an application, I think through continuing education. The combined unit that is the colleges and extension also put one in, and they also have their central home in Madison and have a statewide responsibility. And then some of them are, you know, freestanding campuses. So we will see. But whatever it is, I don't think it's going to change the fact that the directors of women's studies around the state are going to want to get together, which they still will. We also have a state conference every year. The last 5 or 6 years it's been combined with the inclusivity initiative for LGBTQ, and those will most likely continue as well. They also pull in the private colleges in Wisconsin, so it's beyond the UW system. I often present at those conferences, not every year, but I'd say most years, and I'm often on the committee planning the conferences. So this is another avenue where I've kind of worked statewide. Early on, I did more visiting of specific campuses and gave talks about women's studies resources. But as things got more and more electronic, the demand for that, for in-person presentations, went down. So I still do it, or I'll go to a class. UW-Milwaukee taps me for those still, and occasionally elsewhere. But I have less of this kind of circuit rider aspect to the position in favor of really more pushing things out electronically. I kind of enjoyed that, though, going to the different campuses and getting more of a feel for them and meeting some of the faculty beyond the chairs of women's studies. But I haven't particularly pushed it. And it, as a result of that time being somewhat less, not making those trips, I've taken on more in the general library system. I felt like I could use my time then to be on more committees or do other things for the campus here at large, although trying to keep in mind that I still had, you know, UW system in my title and responsibilities. So the other part of this statewide oversight, too, is that in some sense I also report to a advisory panel made up half of librarians and half of women's studies teaching faculty from around the system. And they, or we, meet usually by teleconference these days, and occasionally at either the State Women's Studies Conference or WAL, the Wisconsin Association of Academic Librarians. Since only half of the people are generally even concerned with going to those conferences, it's a little hard to meet at those as a panel, but at least informally, we usually, those of us who are there, have a lunch together. And that group in the early years was very heavily involved in setting policy and oversight of the librarian and many other things. As we've become more institutionalized, the need for certainly any day-to-day or month-to-month supervision by this advisory panel has gone down. We still meet, usually about once a semester now. And I know I use them as a sounding board if we're thinking of doing something new with a publication, either adding or subtracting. We'll talk to them. They were helpful in figuring out that we should get gender in our title. So we now have our new books on women, gender, and feminism, because that's where the discipline is moving, has moved. We added or wanted to add a television series to WAVE, to the video database, and they helped us figure out that we could do that. And also that we had thought maybe we wanted to cut down by time on the videos, let's say, not to bother indexing those that were under 10 minutes. They actually disagreed with that, and they felt that there were some things useful in classrooms that are really short, and we should judiciously continue to select those. So, you know, things like that, things about our publications in particular, they're involved in.
Let me ask you a question, Phyllis. Mm-hmm. When you say gender, that means it includes men as well? Is that the difference between feminism and gender?
Gender is a kind of a slippery term. Sometimes it's just a synonym for women. That's less the case these days, and it's more often inclusive of men and masculinity studies. And of genders. So we always were involved with lesbian studies because they're women, but it also means gay men, it means transgender, intersex, and the others that are bisexuality, and those that are questioning or just call themselves queer. The terminology evolves all the time. Linda Fain, who edits our new books and our WAVE database, just told me Friday that there's a new term for intersex. I can't conjure it up at the moment, but it's like a three-word phrase instead. So we will probably go with whatever the new terminology is. Sometimes we lead, but at least we follow with that. So the field does include now all these gendered aspects of things. The UW-Madison campus program became a department several years ago and added gender to its title. It's the Department of Gender and Women's Studies. It's also the home of the GLBT certificate. So this is right in line with what's going on nationally. Some of the programs in Wisconsin have also changed their name to include gender, and some of them include sexuality as part of their title as well. We have moved to include a lot of gender topics in both New Books on Women, Gender, and Feminism, and in feminist collections. Thus far, and to some extent in feminist periodicals too, there are a lot of the journals that have changed their names to gender, feminist issues became gender issues, things like that. But in WAVE, because we have such a volume of the media productions on women, we have not expanded that one to include men, masculinity, and gay media at large. We just don't have the time. Linda Fain, who does those, as I said, is half time with those two publications, and we just don't have this. If we have the staff, we can maybe do it, but we don't. You know, with a half time person doing those two, that's it.
If you had your druthers, and hypothetically speaking, adding gender and trying to cover would increase your double your area of responsibility or the work involved.
Yes, I think it would today. I mean, some of it, again, like I said, is just a synonym for women. So that stuff is, still as it was, but it also is gender now. But adding in the GLBT and men's studies, I think it would. And I think down the road, the selection duties probably should align more with that, too. Thus far, we haven't made changes here in the general library system, but most likely down the road at some point, whatever is this gender stuff should be one person's responsibility. At least, let's say, within the social sciences, if that's still how the different divisions will be around here. Some other things that having this system responsibility gave me opportunities to do. The director of the consortium, Jackie Ross, pulled me into various projects beyond the consortium, too. So, for example, she had me appointed to the President's Commission on the Status of Women in 1998-99 under President Lyle. So I was involved in year-long study and reports that went on for that, along with various deans and professors from around the UW system. I was the only librarian involved in that. And that's kind of typical, too, with a lot of these things. I'm the librarian. When Jackie herself moved into a position heading a System Institute for Global Studies, she pulled me into that, too, and had me go to various conferences that they sponsored over a few years. I was able to successfully apply for a grant from this Institute for Global Studies as a result of that. And I did one for developing tutorials in international women's studies. So I got this little grant, I think it was for $6,000, and that allowed me to hire a SLIS, a student to work on this project, and that was Pamela O'Donnell, who subsequently became a colleague here and is a librarian in college library. But while she was in SLIS, she and I developed these tutorials. I did most of the content, she did most of the design, but we, you know, we influenced each other. And we went through how to evaluate websites in international women's studies was one of them, how to use Gender Watch effectively in international issues and things like that. So they're still up on the library website, and they still have some usefulness sometimes as a model of tutorials, not necessarily because the content is still active. Although the one on evaluating websites, the themes in that one are really still as valid as they were 10 years ago when those tutorials got mounted. Jackie also had me do a self-study of my office during the first year when I had the job. And I had never heard of a self-study. I didn't even know what it meant. I learned about self-studies, and I learned a lot about the history of the office and the consortium and women's studies and many, many things by having to compile all this data into a document. So that actually taught me a lot and was useful. She also had spearheaded getting a collection going of women's studies videos housed at UW-Platteville. And I prepared the catalog. I looked for additional funding, although I was unsuccessful. But when we did have some funding, I made selections for that collection. Given how easy it became to get materials from campus to campus over the years, having a collection of those kind of materials by name on one campus really didn't serve any purpose anymore. So we kind of dropped that as a specific project. And if I had any money, I would just put them in the Madison collection. So let me think if there's anything else. I was going to talk about that. I'm going to do a little anecdotal stuff. About a year after I got the job, I had this challenge. So, you know, libraries do get challenged from time to time on what they're doing or what they collect. In this case, it had to do with our publications. We used to have to put the publications out for printing bids, I think every 3 years or so. At some point, that must have the rules must have changed, or maybe, I don't really know. We ceased having to do that, but early on we had to do that. So in around 1993 or so, it was time to put these publications out for bids. and they had to be announced in local newspapers, so so that printers could see that and respond to the bid. So I think it was put in the, I think it was probably still the Milwaukee Journal and the Milwaukee Sentinel, or maybe it was just in one of those, put in a Madison paper. Didn't have to be in every paper in the state, at least, but it did have to be in some papers of record. So one person, I don't know if this person was a printer or not, wrote a letter objecting to these feminist publications. And what was the university doing, essentially promoting, I don't remember if his wording was a political perspective or some particular perspective at any rate. He sent the letter to State Senator Kasten at that point, Republican senator in the 90s. Kasten's office looked at the letter, saw it was about the university, said, oh, this is a state matter, not a federal matter. So they sent it to the governor, to Tommy Thompson's office. His office looked at it and called in somebody from the Madison campus, I think, and they said, oh, this is UW system. I mean, it kicked around for a while in the bureaucracy over this one, well, I guess we'd have to call him a constituent, taxpayer, whatever, letter.
I'm sure you're calling him a him.
It was a him. Okay. I don't remember his name, but it was a him. So I think he had the word specialized publications in the letter, now that I think of it. At some point, eventually, somebody took responsibility for having to answer this fellow. And I recall it wasn't me, although I think I was involved in some part in drafting it. You know, there was probably somebody legal. There was someone from system. I don't think the governor's office by that point cared either. But a group of us met and crafted a response. And I do recall that we stuck with this idea of the university can certainly publish and does specialized resources of various types. I believe that we noticed that his name had a Norwegian origin, and one of the examples we cited in the letter was a Norwegian bibliography published by the library. So the letter was, you know, sent to him under whosoever name was officially the respondent, and we never heard boo after that again. But it certainly was a spinning of wheels for some time, as I guess bureaucracies do. We're back in business, thank you. Okay, I just want to say a few more things about system-wide responsibilities, and then I'll turn to things that I've done in the general library system. So I talked about some of those projects that I was involved in with a consortium, not necessarily tied to librarianship. I wanted to mention one that Joanne Lehman, the editor, senior editor in my office, and I have done the last couple of years. There's a feminist publishing class, or feminist editing class, taught at UW-Eau Claire by Teresa Kemp. She's part of a collective that publishes a journal called Feminist Teacher. So in talking to her at one of the consortium meetings, I offered to go up, or have Joanne and me go up to her class and talk about editing and publishing another feminist journal within Wisconsin, within and on women's studies. So she took that offer up, and for the last 2 years, Joanne and I have been up there and spent a session with the students. I give them the background on the office and how we got to be publishing things, some of the issues involved with that, and then Joanne goes into nitty-gritty decision-making, how we operate as a publication, and how we try to do it in a feminist way. So this has been a way to kind of bring in some of my staff, too, because I have a lot of opportunity to do all this stuff outside of the library, outside of Madison, and I like to offer opportunities to others in my staff. Joanne and I both go to the National Women's Studies Association annually, and that's something that having the royalty money allows us to do. We have a booth that we set up there with our publications. We use it as an opportunity to find reviewers for subsequent topics and issues, and really to recharge and learn what is going on in the field, because we go to a lot of sessions. So that's been very useful. And Heather Shimon, who was our office operations associate, also is interested in attending things. And she is an advanced library school student at this point as well. So she has gone to some of the statewide retreats or meetings of the consortium, and she's gone to other local, more library-sponsored workshops. So I've been trying to mentor to mentor her. I've also mentored other students over the years, as has Joanne, through people interested in writing for publication. We had a library school student last year who did quite a bit of writing for us. She did one of these 120-hour practicums. She was a good writer. She wrote two or three long substantive reviews for us in Feminist Collections. And she also is a budding archivist. She did a library research guide on how to find and use archives effectively to do women's history. So, you know, having that kind of an office, we have opportunities to mentor. Heather has also taken that on. She's on the ISIP committee, which is a committee designed to interest undergraduates in library careers. She also developed a curriculum for an ISIP student who did a stint in our office in particular. So, you know, we take seriously the side of being involved, mentoring, teaching students, all of us. Because I get to go to these state conferences and national conferences, I also I went to a lot of American Library Association conferences, given presentations at the national level several times, and on the state level even more. I've also done some internationally. I think the first one was an International Women's Information Conference in Amsterdam that I went to in 1998. Was a speaker at that. Once I'm out there giving these kind of talks, it kind of spirals or snowballs, and I get invited to other ones. From that, to some extent, I got invited to do one at Tulane Conference on Women and Disasters. They did it as part of a panel. It is the right place. It was post the disaster there, but I was on a panel with historians and, you know, looking at how to teach this material ever after. and I'm going to be at one in Finland next month, also Women's Information Conference. But I think it was a result of someone that I met at the Amsterdam Conference in 98. That one day late 2002, I got an email inviting me to be a keynoter at a conference of women's information in India. So, you know, you get all these things in email that are possibly spurious or worse. I looked at this one. This came from a state.gov email, so it kind of looked legitimate. And I answered, yes, I would be potentially interested, but, you know, I needed more information and what all. So it turned out that I actually got sent, paid for by the U.S. State Department to India for 3 weeks in May of 2003. I not only was a keynoter at an international conference in India, but also then the State Department and especially the branch or part of it, the U.S. what had been the USIA, They had me give talks around the country. So I had a few months only, I think it came down to about 2 months to prepare 10 different presentations, you know, all related to library resources, women's studies resources, but slicing the pie kind of different ways. So I prepared all of those. I still didn't quite believe it was going to happen. And in fact, there was some chance that it wouldn't. When the U.S. invaded Iraq, all of these, the embassies and consulates and all were on notice that these programs might be canceled because they were afraid of local disturbances. There was a lot of animosity against the United States at that point, including in allies like India. So it was touch and go. I still had to keep preparing these presentations as if. and then, in fact, and they canceled, I think, their April programs. But they made a decision to go ahead with the May programs. So as a result, I did get to go to India and spend the 3 weeks there, seeing a lot of the country, giving my presentations, meeting a lot of people, learning how other people look at women's issues, getting questions. I mean, just because I was a, you know, an American dealing with women in some way, when I'd give my presentations, I'd get questions on anything regarding women, like who did I think was going to be the first woman president, the other people were interested specifically in women's studies, but they wanted to know, like, how much money does the government give women's studies? So I had to explain that funding academic departments in the United States doesn't come top down from the federal government. I mean, there may be money that comes through grants in the sciences, but the humanities and social sciences don't work like that in large measure. So, you know, differences in cultural expectations. Research on women's issues in India is mostly through non-governmental organizations and to some extent through governmental ones. Here, we also have a lot of active women's organizations, but I'd say the majority of the actual research is done in the university. So, you know, I learned a different perspective on a lot of that through the that experience. I had some specifically Jewish experiences in India. I mean, the percentage of Jews in the Indian population is 0.000 something, but because I had that interest and my handlers saw that in my resume, they offered me opportunities to touch base with the Jewish community, particularly in Mumbai. So they were able to get me in touch or have that person set up a visit for me with a Jewish women's group in Mumbai. And it was right before a Jewish holiday, and they had the women who came to this group prepared delicacies in honor of the holiday. This was on my last day in India. I had not gotten sick. I had been scrupulous in choosing what to eat and not eat throughout the 3 weeks. And of course, they put me up in very nice hotels, so it wasn't too much of a problem. But I ate no street food, you know, whatever. I only had bottled water. So here I was at this Jewish women's group, and they had all these delicacies out. And not only was I supposed to try them, but they wanted to me to be the judge of the so this was a little bit of a problem. I really didn't want to get sick on the plane going home. Didn't want to insult these women. So I caucused in another room with the leader of the group, and explained the situation. So what we came up with is I would judge the presentation, and she would judge the taste. And these women were, you know, very gung-ho about making sure, you know, that they would win or whatever. So, you know, we came back out. We figured out a lot of winners for different types of presentation and different types of tastes, and had everybody come out happy. So, you know, but I learned through that there were, you know, certainly some Jews in India, and these women were mostly Marathi speaking only. They did not know any English, so they were not from, you know, the most educated class in India. And then because I had visited them and I had visited synagogues that are mostly kind of museum-like now in Kolkata, because there are only a handful of Jews living there, at any rate, I was able to develop a presentation when I came back and did more research on it, too, about the Jews in India, which I gave to some community groups. And I also, of course, gave presentations about the professional aspects of the trip, both at the Wisconsin Association of Academic Libraries, where I was a lunch speaker, and at the State Women's Studies Conference. So that I would say that was one of the highlights of my career here, having that opportunity. And let me see if there's anything else statewide or, well, again, because of this sort of national and international prominence, I get asked to serve on a lot of national women-focused initiatives or to advise women's publications. It's kind of like when they need the library perspective, I become the obvious choice to ask to serve on these national initiatives. So, for example, there was a national network of women's funds, and they were working on their grants classification system. So they asked me to be involved in that. So we had conference call meetings and devised a way of thinking about how to classify women and girls grants. Then there was a center at Towson State University called the National Center for Curriculum Transformation. And curriculum transformation is also kind of, I don't know if you'd call it a euphemism, but the main curriculum transformation that was going on was how to infuse general courses with women and gender material and perspectives. So they had a group of curriculum consultants nationally. I was asked to be one of those, and I went to three-day weekend things at Towson State a few times, again with, in that case, rather prominent leaders in women's studies from around the country. I was and sort of still am an academic advisor to the Jewish Women's Archive Project. And lately, I've advised the National Council for Research on Women about developing their website. Two journals that have tapped me recently about website inclusion in database aggregators, things like that, are Lilith, which is a Jewish feminist magazine, and Ms. Magazine. So these things are kind of fun for me, too, to be able to have some national influence, and they really come out of having the national or international opportunities. Having all that made me kind of a logical person to be put up for distinguished academic librarian here in the on campus, and I did get granted that distinguished prefix in 1999. Lately, I've served on a committee of other people on with other people on the campus who review the applications for the distinguished prefix, and then I was also on a committee looking at the guidelines, and we reviewed the guidelines for distinguished. There are very few people on campus who are who actually apply or have the applications submitted on their behalf. So we tried to come up with ways that more people would be eligible for even applying for that title. So those are some kind of campus-wide things that I've been involved in. I did want to talk a little more about what I do in the general library system, or have done. So like I was saying, I have a little more time after the first several years of the job, because I wasn't being used as much directly on the other campuses and having to do the travel connected with that. So that let me serve more on local committees. I served for 15 years on the Equity Action Committee, which David chaired for many or all of those years, I think. I served and continue to serve on the Cairns Committee. This is a supervisory Oversight Committee for a special collection on American women writers. Those things I was doing even beforehand. But what I took on afterwards, I was the convener of the Memorial Bibliographers Group for a couple of years. I worked on the storage committee for also with David, committees for several years. And as endemic as storage issues are around here, it seems like various e-book related committees have also been endemic. And I've been on at least three of those and continue to serve on two of them right now. So one of them we came up with a what's called patron-driven acquisition pilot program through one vendor, where we put in records into the library catalog for lots of books that we don't own, but potentially would own if we had the money for all of them, and if our patrons or users actually want to use them. So we ran a successful pilot. We didn't get things that we were upset about getting, and we were able to use, again, the decreasing amounts of money that we have around here to buy some things that were actually used by people. And I'm on a more e-books at large committee that's looking more at lots of issues with respect to e-books, including interlibrary loan and reserves and other things that poses new issues, whether to buy packages as a whole, whether to increase this kind of patron-driven approach, many things that that e-books raise, and they're interesting issues. So I've been on and volunteer for many of those kind of things as they come up. I also, in the last year or two, well, I was on the committee that advised, tweaked our catalog, MadCat, for many years. It's called the OPEC Issues Committee. And then as the new catalog, known as the Library Catalog, was under development here in-house, that committee to do a lot of tweaking on MadCat ended, but we had a little ongoing committee called the MadCat team for just things that were really important that had to be essentially fixed. But otherwise, we mostly have not been doing a lot of ongoing maintenance to the catalog, to MadCat, in favor of spending time and effort helping with the development of the new catalog. So our MadCat team met monthly with the development team for the new catalog. We gave a lot of feedback. I gave so much feedback that actually I got a little award at the when they flipped the switch and made the library catalog the default catalog on our website in May. I got to be the one to press the button or flip the switch or whatever, given the feedback. So I take that kind of responsibility very seriously and try to be a good citizen in the general library system to the evolving needs of our patrons and our staff. Also on the campus, I attend most department meetings of the Gender and Women's Studies Department. Mostly to just keep in touch with the people who are the faculty on the committee and to know what things that they're dealing with. In my selection duties, I actually evolved into that. I didn't have selection duties for the first 3 or 4 years I had the position. Again, there was an emphasis on the system and not so much on the local campus, but and also Sue Searing, my predecessor, kept those duties while she was deputy or acting deputy director of the library. When that became permanent for her and my position became permanent, she also ceded the selection duties to me. So I then had to rethink a little bit my the different parts of my job and figure out how to get that amount of duties in there, because it, again, is a small budget. It's not that the selection requires that much time, but there's two other meetings then that puts me in on a monthly basis, and other collective actions of people who are selectors. So it takes a certain amount of time. I still mostly define the position as a public services position, both with respect to the system as a whole and in the general library system. So that means doing things like creating the tutorials that I mentioned some time ago, maintaining the website, oversight of our publications, and then creating specific library research guides, either for our library course guides, either for specific courses or to serve the needs of some segment of the user population at large. So I think that's most of what I've done. I know you asked me to think about my thoughts on changes in libraries over the years or coming up. And, you know, I think the biggest factor for us in the library is that, you know, how do you keep doing quality service with less money? Fewer people doing the services, less money to buy things, and less money to do things. And it makes it kind of less fun for us, too, because it's much harder. It's much more time-consuming to have to pick and choose when you don't have enough money to buy all of the things that really, in my view, and I'm sure shared with my selector colleagues, a university of this size and caliber really ought to have. So that's problematic. There have also been lots and lots of retirements. The colleagues that I came in with or knew or were here before me, just about everybody has retired. And I have to come to grips with being one of the old-timers. I do feel like an old-timer some of the time, although I do try to keep up with all the new stuff so that I don't feel further and further, you know, behind, or whatever that word is, superannuated, I think?
Superfluous.
What?
Superfluous.
Superfluous. There we go. Okay. And I do value my newer, younger colleagues, many of them too, and I try to keep up with them professionally and personally. But, you know, at some point this career will come to an end, and someone else will get an opportunity to have this wonderful position as UW System Women's Studies Librarian.
You don't think this is a position that's any kind of fiscal danger then?
I don't know. Right now, I don't think so. I haven't heard a whiff of any issue with respect to the office. But money is increasingly tight. I really don't know. I do think it would be appropriate to have more Madison-specific duties carved into the position. As I mentioned, I think all of the gender, at least gender in the social science stuff, should be part of the selection duties. Possibly some other areas of selection could be included as well. And a lot of what I've done in the way of public service is for the Madison campus is not so specifically spelled out in the position description. Possibly that needs to be more firmed up, I'd say, for my successor, so that it's clear that this is that Madison is paying for this position, and you know, it should be getting presumably the bulk of time and effort from the person. So I think those things will happen. I hope the decision will not be made to disband the office, but don't know.
Seems unlikely because it's it.
Oh, okay, you can turn off. I think I've done.
This is the end of Phyllis's second interview, and I want to thank her for being able to go into so much detail and undergoing so much preparation for this. Thanks, Phyllis.
You're welcome. Enjoyed it.